everybody. Welcome back to my channel. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you're new here, welcome. If you've been here before, I hope you know how much I love and appreciate you all. I'm trying really hard to broaden my horizons on the criminals that I research, because as lengthy as the history of the mafia is, let's face it, if I'm putting out a video every single week, I'm gonna run out of mafia members. Especially because a lot of times, by telling one mafia member's story, you're kind of telling a bunch of them. Even in my Paul Castellano video, I very much felt like I was just repeating information. I was taking information from my other videos and putting it in that one. So I'm trying to broaden my horizons on the kind of criminals that I research, and I'm pretty psyched about this one because it is so far outside of my usual subject that I feel like I can get a lot of new information that I never knew before. And while I was researching, I did learn a lot of freaking stuff. Honestly, it's outside of my knowledge in general, like not just even my knowledge on the subjects that I do research on. I really didn't know half of the stuff that I was researching. I'm like your typical ignorant American that has never left the country and knows next to nothing about the rest of the world around us. So I like doing research and finding out stuff about other cultures. And this is kind of the way that I do that. Tonight's episode is based on a mafia don in the Middle East, which means I am going to try my absolute hardest, but there's a very strong chance, like 100% chance, that I am going to butcher the crap out of the names of the people, the places, and the things that I mention here. Please don't drag me too badly. I'm doing my absolute best. I am terrible at pronouncing English and Italian words. It's gonna happen. I'm gonna mess up all over the place tonight, and I sincerely apologize. I'm really excited also to do this video because there's legit next to no information out there about this guy for English-speaking viewers. I was looking him up and I could not find one video about him in English. The only ones that I could find about him that were in English was legit just reading off word for word his Wikipedia page. There's other info out there about him other than just the Wikipedia page, but there's no videos on him. So I really hope that you guys enjoy learning about this guy. And I hope that if anybody is ever interested in him, they stumble upon this episode. So let's go ahead and get into this week's criminal. Karim Lalla, born Abdul Karim Sher Khan, was born sometime in 1911. Now, if we think that records were badly kept in Italy and America, the area that he was born put us to shame. So I have no idea what day in 1911 he was born. I just know that he was born in 1911. He was born in the Kunar province of Afghanistan. Sometime in the 1930s, the family moved back to the Bendi Bazaar, one of the poorest and most populated areas in South Mumbai. There's nothing that says exactly when he and his family moved to the area of Bendi Bazaar, just that it was sometime between the 1930s and the 1940s, so I'm assuming it's somewhere closer to 1930, which would make Lalla 19 years old. I saw somewhere that it was probably when he was 21 years old that he moved, so let's call it 1933 that he moved. It's somewhere in between there, but yeah, 21, sure, let's go with that. When he first got to the area, he started working on the Bombay docks. It's kind of funny because so many of the mafia members that I cover start out doing exactly that same thing, working at the docks. I feel like the docks might be like a gateway job. The way that people say that weed is a gateway drug to harder drugs, I feel like the docks is like a gateway job into organized crime, which is pretty friggin' hilarious because, like, think about all the people that we've covered on here that have worked at the docks in the past. Maybe it's just like this seedy area that no matter where in the world you go, it's crime ridden. At the docks, he got hooked up with a gang. It all started out because he was smuggling hashish, diamonds, and gems through the Mumbai dockyards. This is where he gets his jumping off point to go into all criminal empires, because he makes a shit ton of money being the biggest smuggler in Bombay at the time, and he decides to start his own gang. The gang were called the Pashtuns, or the Pathans, as they're known in India, and they were sort of independent contractors. They were hired by landlords and by loan sharks pretty regularly. They'd be hired by landlords when they had tenants that wouldn't pay their rent, but they wouldn't leave, and the landlord had no idea what to do. He didn't want to go through the nightmare process of going to court and legally evicting him, so what does he do? The gang is filled with super tall, super burly men that have a very scary presence about them. So they would just go around and illegally evict a tenant if they weren't paying their rent. They'd show up to a place and they would just start moving that person's stuff out. And like, what are you really gonna do? You have these huge guys at your house. You know you haven't paid rent. You live in the absolute worst place that there is in the entire country that you live in. So if you call the cops, chances are cops aren't even gonna show up. And if they do, they're probably not going to do anything about the situation that you're in. So what are you going to do? You're just going to let them evict you. Lala fit right in with this gang that he created and the people that were around him at the docks. He stood almost 7 feet tall, and he definitely had one of those, like, I will kill you and I will do it very easily kind of vibes about him. Like, nowhere does anybody accuse this guy of being, like, a gentle giant or really nice. Like, you could definitely tell he was an asshole. So eventually, as any criminal knows, the racket of illegal evictions and collecting on debts from loan sharks that couldn't collect themselves, it's just not cutting it anymore. They're making so much money in smuggling that they decide that they want to go into other areas of crime. The gang started to move into illegal gambling. In Mumbai, it's called Satta, and I really am having a lot of trouble figuring out what the hell this is. It seems like Satta and Matka go together, and it's kind of like the illegal lotteries that the mafia used to run in New York City. It used to involve betting on the opening and closing rates of cotton transmitted from the New York Textile Trade Cotton Exchange to the Bombay Cotton Exchange or the Mumbai Textile Trade. So it seems like it's somewhat of a cross between like Wall Street betting and the illegal lotteries that the mafia used to run. I don't know. It's very confusing. When you Google it, you come upon a bunch of numbers and locations. So I'm assuming it either has something to do with the exchange rates of some good or service, or it's lottery numbers. I don't really know. I'll put a picture over here. You tell me. Matka gambling is illegal in India after the Public Gambling Act was passed in 1967, making both betting establishments and Satka Matka houses completely outlawed in the entire country. It seems like they made gambling illegal because it undermines people who gained their wealth through manual labor, and also because it has a habit of increasing the instances of addiction as well as domestic abuse as a result of, like, the dissatisfaction of the outcome of gambling. And because men are just, like, throwing their money all over the place and spending it on these games, it led to criminal offenses such as money fraud. So overall, the government just decided to completely outlaw it. And I've talked about this on this channel before, but in my opinion, I don't think the government cares at all whatsoever about anything that happens after somebody's gambling. That would not make sense because then, you know, make it illegal to go watch sporting events and drink alcohol, because how many times have we seen entire cities go on fire because people are mad about the outcome of a football game? It's impossible to outlaw everything that could piss people off. No, that's not what it is. What it is that it is way too easy to make money gambling and not report it to the government so that they can take their share. It seems like all of the forms of gambling and betting may fall into this category of sata and matka. Anything from like roulette, poker boards, and all of these kind of ways of gambling, you know, betting on cotton exchange rates, anything that's gambling, is seen to fall into the sata matka category. And if you're caught partaking in any kind of gambling at all in India, you will have criminal charges levied against you, as well as wage garnishments. So I don't know if wage garnishments is kind of like the same thing as getting a fine in America. It seems like it is. Instead of just saying, oh, you owe $20,000, they say like, oh, we're taking 20% of your income for the next XYZ. So originally in the 1950s, the big matka was the cotton exchange rates. When the New York textile trade stopped operating in 1961, it moved to all sorts of exchange rates. So figure like anything that has a cost on it or like a number on it can be bet on. The same way you could do at Wall Street. You can do any of this on Wall Street legally, but you pay more because you pay a tax. So there's one game that I kept seeing when they kept talking about like sata houses. It is confusing as hell. There's a specific way to play it. I'm going to explain it to the best of my abilities. I'm hoping you kind of understand what I'm reading because I don't understand it at all whatsoever. So you let me know if you get it because I don't. The match starts with the participant selecting an initial series of 3 digits from 0 to 9, such as like, let's say 2, 5, and 8. The sum of these 3 integers is put into the process of addition, so like 2 + 5 + 8 = 15. The very first digit is removed from the whole number, so the number that you're going to have is 5, because, you know, you have 15, first number's taken off, your number is now 5. The ultimate choice appears like this, like 2, 5, 8 × 5. After that, the participant selects the next sequence of figures rigorously. For instance, 3, 6, 9. 3 + 6 + 9 = 18, which leaves you with the number 8. As a result, the next set of figures is 3, 6, 9 × 8. Then you make your gamble when your entire pick has been finalized. So you do all this math and you make your gamble. You can implement a price of various betting concerning the numbers that you've picked, such as the one that pays you 9 times your investment when your first option is accurate. The lotto tickets will be picked without any factor after you have entered your claims, and any successful winnings are able to be cashed out immediately. So when you look at the results in real time, I'm talking like nowadays, right here, right now, there's 3 digits, then 2 digits, then 3 digits, and there's a location for each one. I hope someone watching understands even a little bit of what I'm trying to explain, but honestly, I don't. So it's totally fine if you don't. I get it, because if I don't understand it, I mean, no one's going to judge you for not getting it. But this is a game, they love to play it in Mumbai, so maybe they're just like way smarter, I don't know. So after they get into the illegal gambling, the matka and the satka, the gang starts to branch out as well. So now they go into matka, they go into sata, and they start becoming very successful, and they're like, all right, what's next? What next area of crime can we move into? So they get into liquor dens. The Bombay Prohibition Act was passed in 1949, making purchasing, possessing, or using any liquor or alcohol without a valid permit completely prohibited. As I've said a kabillion times on this channel, any form of prohibition in any country is going to lead to a complete and total opening for organized crime to flourish. And in cases like America, it makes a foothold that exists long after prohibition even ended. The crazy thing about this one, though, is that there is still to this day a Prohibition Act in place in Bombay. A documentary filmmaker, Preeti Chandriani, was arrested in 2013 for possessing liquor for the purpose of making, like, those chocolate liqueurs at home. He was arrested. So that's how seriously they take this liquor prohibition in Bombay. So now, the gang is obviously alive and flourishing in 1949 when Prohibition becomes put in place. And as soon as that happens, like, on the books, this gang comes in and opens a whole shit ton of illegal liquor dens because everybody's going to drink. It's just gonna happen, whether they buy it and go drink it in their house or they buy it and they go to some club or liquor den, like, it's gonna happen, period. There's nothing you can do to stop it. The insane amount of profits allows them to grow even more exponentially, because look at the mafia during the time of Prohibition in America. They were making money hand over fist from the sale of illegal alcohol, but they still went into other things, and that's what we're seeing here. They are taking over specific markets and then moving into the next one. Lala decides to begin putting money on the streets, as we know it here in America, usury, and he makes a shit ton of money on that, obviously. You know, you charge a vig and you make a lot of money putting loans out on the street, especially when you have a gang full of, like, gigantic dudes that are more than happy to go beat people up if they don't pay you back. And he starts to steer his gang in the direction of the protection racket, which is known as Hafta. Hafta seems to be a problem in India to this very day. Like, a lot of these problems that we're talking about to this current day are still going on over there. The police force in India are seen as a very scary, very corrupt group of people that only protect certain people. The police force of India was set up in the time that the British Empire still ruled over India. Honestly, it's a little crazy for us as Americans to imagine this because we gained our independence so long ago. But India only gained independence from Britain on August 15th, 1947. On the contrary, America gained independence from Britain on July 4th, 1776. So that was a lot longer ago. Plus, I don't know why, but like any date that has the number 19 at the beginning still feels like super recent times to me, because I was born in a year that had 19 on the beginning of it. So even if it's like 1901, it still feels like modern history to me because I lived in that generation. Look at how many mafia members that I've covered that were born in like 1889 and their insane lives were lived through the 1900s, but there was people that lived at the same time that I lived that were born in the 1800s. So anything that goes on in the 1900s, it feels like modern history to me. So the fact that it took India until 1947 to gain independence is just wild. The reason that I bring that issue up is because the police in India seem to have become extortionists. They collect Hafta the same way that Lala did in the past, and that's going on again to this day. The police force was originally instated by the British powers when India was still under British control, and the force mainly operates the same way today that it did back in the day that the British were ruling it. The police collect slash extort money the same way as the mafia does. They collect it for protection on a weekly or a monthly basis. And this protection money is collected from legit people. People who own shops, traders, transporters, rickshaw pullers, shopkeepers, everybody pays a Hafta to kind of be protected from everything. Hafta is also collected from people who operate on the black market. People doing illegal activities such as like sex workers, drug dealers, pickpockets, thieves. People doing satka matka activities, the works. Everyone doing something illegal is paying Hafta to someone. A former secretary of the government is quoted as saying, "Every additional police station in Delhi means more crime." This is pretty wild to think about because, like, yeah, I moan and gripe about the police on this channel a lot. It isn't a secret that I absolutely despise police, and I think that they're the most useless human beings in the world, especially where I am. I think that's why I have that view, because I'm in Suffolk County, New York, and Suffolk County PD are the most backward, inept group of human beings on the planet. Honestly, NYPD is pretty chill. Like, I've had some wild experiences with the NYPD. They've helped me chase down a truck that ran over my car. There's been a lot of experiences that I've had with the NYPD, but you could tell that they have their shit together. I've had some bad experiences with them as well, but even when I'm having those bad experiences, it's just because they're doing their job, not because they are just straight up assholes. I had the Suffolk County cops at my in-law's house last night. First, let me say, I did not call the cops. And I mercilessly mocked every single person who expected that any kind of good result would come from calling the police. And legit, the second that that cop opened his mouth, I immediately wanted to spit in his face. They're just so freaking full of themselves. Like, this man really thought he was the shit, even though he was so fat he hasn't seen his feet in, like, many, many years. He came up on us, like, thinking he was the shit, had this attitude the second he opened his mouth. But all I could think about was, like, bro, I would annihilate you on a PT test. Like, let's go PT test to PT test, and then we could talk about, like, who deserves to have this attitude. As expected, no results were gained from the police coming. It did absolutely nothing, just as Suffolk County cops usually do. So it wasn't like a surprise. And again, I just mocked everybody that was like, oh yeah, we'll call the cops. That'll do it. That'll do the job. No, that's never the job. That's never the answer. You never call the police. Like, that's never going to get you where you want to go. Anyway, the point of that is that as bad as the cops that I've interacted with are, they're nowhere near the level of corruption that I've seen over in India. It seems to have gotten to a point that, like, legit, even honest, legit policemen, they can't make it in the police force. They're passed over for promotions, they're passed over for raises, they're ignored and just kind of, like, pushed to the side as crooked cops that collect hafta from everybody from, like, taxi drivers to business owners. And those guys are praised, those guys are promoted, and their wages are increased. Why? Because there's police at every level of authority in India that are collecting these payments. The beat cops that do the collections and collect it from the people on the street, they collect that money and then they hand up envelopes to people in higher authority in the police force. It's the same way that soldiers in the mafia collect money from the people that they're protecting, and they hand the money up to the capos, and then it goes up and up and up, you know what I mean. But as far as the police force goes, it's an infrastructure that has been in place for so long, and such a huge percentage of the police force is operating this way, that it's almost impossible to stop it now. Unless you get rid of every policeman in India, like, not, oh, we're gonna sit here and figure out who's a bad cop and who's a good cop, like, just get rid of every single one of them and start from scratch. That is really the only option, and that's not an option at all, so I don't know. This hafta system with the police has caused a lot of problems in the country as well. Construction in the cities is completely dangerous and completely hazardous. They are regularly violating bylaws and zoning laws because police are the ones that are supposed to watch out and make sure that those laws aren't broken. And they turn the other way as long as the people that are building those buildings are providing their hafta every week. Ordinary citizens know better than to turn to police if they need help, kind of like here. You will never catch me calling the police. Like, I will 100% of the time take care of my own issues. I'll show up. If I know, like, okay, cops are on their way, I'll show up and I'll tell everybody, shut the fuck up and just keep your mouth shut until the police go away. They're not gonna help. They're not gonna do anything. Just shut up. Don't get yourself arrested, because that's the only outcome that's going to come of this. Either they're going to leave, or you're going to get yourself arrested, and then they're going to leave. So, like, I promise you, nothing's going to come of it. Just shut up. But you'll never catch me having something go wrong and then, like, calling the police, like, oh my god, please help. Like, no, that's is not how it works. But there, it's even worse, because these guys in India are actually really corrupt. So, like, if I call the police, I have a sort of chance of getting a good outcome. You know, like, Police in Yonkers, they're pretty decent. They found my car when it got stolen. NYPD, they're pretty decent. Like, if I'm in Suffolk County and I have to call the police, nine times out of ten, nothing's going to happen. But I do have the chance of getting that one in ten cop that will actually care. And even the asshole cops that do absolutely nothing with themselves, they're not corrupt. They're just lazy and pieces of shit. But in India, these police are straight up corrupt. Citizens know better than to turn to them for any kind of help, and typically they just handle matters amongst themselves. Obviously, that is unless one of the parties are already partaking in a hafta payment. If you get into a traffic accident, if somebody steals from you at your house, if you get mugged on the street, you handle it yourself. That's just the way it is. That's the way I live my life, honestly. Like, when my car got stolen, the only reason I called the police was because I needed a police report in order to report it to my insurance company. There was no part of me that was like, oh yeah, the police are gonna help, this will be great. Like, no. I'm surprised they found my car. I really am. I did not expect them to find my car. They did. More power to them. Thanks so much, Yonkers police. But I did not expect that. That was not the aim of, like, me calling and being like, hey, police, like, can you come help? Like, no. That's, no. Anyway, when you have an entire population of people that look at it like that, that look at it like, okay, the police are zero help to me, they're not gonna do anything for me, and they decide to take the law into their own hands, it leads to an entire population that starts to brutalize each other, or they get muscle men that they hire, and those muscle men settle scores on their behalf. In India, the police are the most feared by the weak and the honest people who don't know how to bribe cops. But the police are very cultivated by the powerful people and the dishonest people, you know? Like, they are very supported by the higher-ups that know the game. Either way, police have 100% lost respect in the society of India. Lala got into the hafta business for exactly this reason. Citizens started to strongly distrust the police. Sometimes, even when they would make their hafta payments to the police, they would still find their stores looted or their people being harassed and arrested by the police for no reason. In areas where crime is at such a height that the police can't, or even in this case won't, control it, a common practice is to turn to the enemy that you know. Local gangs will protect you. The people started to pay hafta to Lala to have their businesses or their personal interests protected. Lala became really good friends with a lot of people that worked in the police department, and he would give them a share of his business in the area that the police are working in. Him making those concessions allowed him to control the police force and protect the people that he promised to protect. Honestly, paying hafta to Lala and having Lala protect you to the police and from the police was probably a lot safer than just skipping the middleman and going directly to the police with your hafta. Because Lala would be the one that would step in and, you know, if you're paying your hafta, he's gonna make sure that you're protected. The police, they don't. He started to employ a large number of people. He promised the people that worked for him that they would have a better life, that he would pay them really well, and that their families, as well as themselves, would be safe and secure. And a lot of people took him up on this offer. By this point, he had monopolized the smuggling market. He put a lot of people to work in that capacity. He had a lot of other illegal activities going on, so there's always a place that you can put new employees to work. So he always had openings for people that were looking for employment. After a while, the Patoon gang started to move into contract killing. A contract is called a supari in India. And supari killing is a pretty normal thing in the underground world in India. Somebody steal from you? You hire somebody to handle that. You don't call the cops and expect them to get your stuff back. You hire somebody to handle it. It still goes on even now to this day. India is fighting to make supari killers less of a prominent career, but I found news reports from two men that had been hired to kill Ashtok Sabharwal in 2004. They had been hired by a competitor of Sabharwal in his career. So pretty much like he owned a business, let's say he was a bread shop. Another bread shop like got mad that he was selling so much bread and they wanted to take him out instead of like making their own bread better. So these two guys got arrested after they were hired to kill Ashtok. A woman was arrested on July 17th, 2022 for the Supari killing of her mother-in-law. In that case, her father-in-law had hired her to kill her mother-in-law because he wanted to get married again, and he was not permitted to get married again until or unless his wife died. Nowadays, Supari killers in Bengaluru will kill for 10,000 rupees, which equals $121 in US currency. Some of them have even killed for prices as low as a cell phone or a t-shirt. In 2018 and 2019, over 30 contract killing cases had been taken up by the city police. And that's in Bengaluru alone. And that's just the ones that were taken up by police. So imagine how many of them are actually happening. In 2021, two engineers in Mumbai gave a Supari for their senior's murder because he didn't give them a promotion that they were hoping to get. So, you know, they have a senior employee. They're hoping to get a promotion from this senior. He doesn't give it to them, so they hire two men to kill the senior employee. And it's done for all kinds of reasons. Women will pay a Supari to get out of marriages. Builders will pay a Supari to have men who question their projects killed. It's like an insane problem. The value of human life is next to nothing over there. Lala and the Pashtun gang would regularly carry these killings out, along with kidnapping for ransom, and they would be in the drug dealing and counterfeit money production markets. So they made sure to spread out to every single facet of criminal life. In his life, Lala married two women. He had one daughter with each of those women. And eventually, one of those daughters had a son, and Lala raised his grandson as his own son. I don't know what happened. Honestly, there's no information. I can't even find his daughter's names or his wife's names. I have no freaking idea. But there's nothing out there that says why he raised his grandson as his son. Like, did his daughter die? Was she unable to raise him? I don't really know. But he did end up raising this grandson as his own son. I know nothing about these wives. Like, I don't know if these women knew about each other. I don't know if they were at the same time. I don't know if they lived together. I really don't know shit about this entire situation, and I can't find it anywhere. Legit, the only information that I can find is that he has two wives who each had a daughter for him. Full stop, nothing else. On the legitimate side of things, Lala owned two hotels and a travel agency. His hotels, Al Karim Hotel and New India Hotel, operated as regular hotels. And the travel agency, New India Tours and Travel, did the same thing. These businesses actually operated as the businesses that they were supposed to operate as. But, on the other hand, they were the perfect way to wash his money. So, although India didn't have the stringent tax laws that America has, they still need to show an origination for where all of this money is coming from. So, these hotels and agencies that Lala owned, they're the perfect way to do this. Because you can just say that you rented out the entire hotel that night, and in real life, you've only rented out two or three rooms. You know, it's easy to wash money through something like that. To an outsider, Lala seemed like an upstanding businessman. It seemed like he was wildly successful, but honestly, he didn't live the lavish lifestyle. You know, he wasn't wearing diamond wrist watches and driving Bentleys. Like, he was a lot more low-key. So it was a little easier to understand the success that he was going through. You know, it's not like he's living life like he's a kabillionaire and he only owns a few businesses. He lived life like someone who owned two businesses or three businesses. Most people, though, they know that this is a mafia don and that he's someone that you do not want to screw with. And they just know that because everybody in India knows that Karim Lalla is a mafia don. Like, it's well-known information. Although Lalla was constantly detained and questioned by police, he really never did any serious time in prison. He is considered as related to two other big-time criminals, and these are two other gang lords that are in the area at the same time as him. Haji Mastan and Vadarajan Madaliir. So that's one of them, and Haji Mastan is the other one, and these are two big-time gang lords in the area that he's operating in that are working at the same time as him. And these three mafia dons, they start working together during a time of crisis. As far as reputation and influence goes, Lalla is known as the first mafia don of Mumbai's underworld. Some people refer to Haji as the first don, but experts that have studied this stuff, people that are well-informed on the subject, they tip their hat to Lalla. Haji himself has referred to Lalla as the real Don. He's also referred to as the last king of the Pashtun community. At one point, both of these other men were arrested, and it was, like, super weird that Lalla wasn't also getting arrested and getting put in jail. Looking from the outside in, I mean, if these two other gang lords that are doing the same kind of shiesty shit that he's doing are going to jail, it would only be logical to expect him to go to jail as well. A lot of people saw Lalla not getting arrested, and they assumed that this is just a testament to Lalla having a lot of police and Congress in his pocket. It's well known that he consorts with Congress, and he consorts with, like, famous bigwig rich people in the country, and that is how they explain him not getting arrested or going to jail. Most people still believe that his connection to Congress is what spared him jail time, but people like Baljeet Parmar, a veteran crime journalist, claim that he didn't go to jail because he wasn't really involved in the same kind of things that the other gang lords were involved in. They were really heavy into smuggling. They were smuggling gold, silver, and other material goods, and Lalla had kind of backed away from that industry. In the past, he had monopolized the smuggling game, but either he backed his entire gang away from it, or he himself stepped away from it, so there was no ties between him and whoever is doing the smuggling for him. He's making a lot more money through the illegal gambling and liquor dens, protection rackets, all that shit. So when the hammer came down on these other guys, it came down on smugglers. And because Lala's not really that interested in this level of crime anymore, he didn't go down with the rest of them. So says Parmar, this veteran crime journalist. So I'm gonna level with you here. I've seen it written in a lot of places that Lalla started working with the Pathan gang and that they were already an existing source, and it didn't take long for him to rise through the ranks and take over as the chief of this Pathan gang. But I've also seen that he started the Pathan gang, so I don't really know. It could be one of the two things. At the end of the day, he is the one that's known. Like, if you think the Pathan gang, if you think of that, you think of Karim Lalla. But I'm not 100% sure if the gang was already standing and he joined it and just took it over really quick, or if he started it himself. The gang as a whole had come to be known for the contract killings, the forced evictions, the kidnapping, and the extortion that they're regularly carrying out. They are also the place that you would go if you're looking to get into a Karam club. A Karam club is a facade for the illegal money lending, the gambling, and betting rackets that they are doing. And pretty much these Karam clubs, they kind of served as like a headquarters for groups. So like, the Pathan gang has groups over here, 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 and here, and they would open a Karam club over there. And just, you know, that would be their clubhouse. These Karam clubs are mainly located in the slums and the poorest areas in the entire area that they're in, obviously. The criminal things always have to be located in places that police just do not like to go. I mean, this is India, and I would assume that most of these clubs, they pay for protection to the police, so they really don't have much to worry about. But they're also not too worried about their joint getting busted down by an overzealous cop that decides that he's gonna be a good cop today, you know? Either way, cops would be much quicker to look the other way when they're dealing with an illegal gambling den in the slums than they are in a nicer area, where higher class people might get offended by a Karam club's presence. Over the years, in the slums of Mumbai, entire cultures have flourished in the underground worlds and the slums. There's underground hip-hop collectives, fight clubs, bodybuilding centers, Karam clubs all over the place, and they're able to thrive pretty well in the slums where nobody is looking to clean up the illegal activity that's going on around them. These Karam clubs were always considered to be the breeding grounds for recruitment into crime. The clubs, they start to get packed around 7 p.m. They are open all day, so like kids would go there during the day and, you know, play and whatever. But they start to get packed at 7 p.m. with college students and men that got off of work. And they are there to play the game of Karam, hence the name Karam Club. This game involves a board, pieces that look like checkers pieces, and you slide them. I couldn't for the life of me explain what the hell goes into this game, but I'll put a few pictures up here of people playing, and you tell me if you can decipher it. So they are going about their lives, running all of these crimes, and everything's going fine. And then the 1970s hit, and shit starts to go absolutely wild. Wars start to break out between people in the area that support one of the three ganglords in the area. Karim Lala, Haji Mastan, and the other guy whose name is super hard to pronounce. When things start to go a little sideways, these three men sit down together and they designate territory within Mumbai where their people can operate freely. In their designated areas, they are free to run all the criminal activity their hearts can desire, and they're free to do whatever the hell they want. But they aren't allowed to encroach on the area for the other gangsters. As long as these territories are established and respected, things are gonna go fine, because there's about to be a war between people that support each one of these drug lords. So let's just designate areas. You keep your people in your area, I'll keep my people in my area, period, point blank, no reason to fight. Again, remember that this is organized crime. This ain't no low-level street gangs fighting it out. These are the top of the top gangsters that are in the area. You know what fighting does? Like, yeah, it costs lives, it hurts people, it devastates communities, yada, yada, yada. But at the end of the day, what fighting really does is cost these guys money. And they're not trying to fight no war, they're trying to settle this as quick as they can so that they can go about making more money. So Lala used to hold a weekly darbar. You know how there's always like a lord or a king or something, and they sit on the throne, and people from the village or whatever they're lording over, they come and pretty much like they complain about their chickens being killed by wolves, or that their neighbor is building on their land, and it's up to that lord or king or whoever to resolve this dispute. Well, if you watch those type of shows and you know what I'm talking about, great. If you haven't, I hope you get the gist. The person in power allows regular citizens to come to them to air any grievances they may have or anything that they need help having fixed. And those lords or kings or whatever will either help them solve this problem or tell them to shut the fuck up and deal with it. That's pretty much what Lala does. He allows people from all walks of life, all backgrounds, all different wages and ages, and he allows them all to come before him. And if there's any grievances that anybody has that they need help with that he can actually provide help to, he'll help them. Sometimes he'll help financially. Other times he'll help to settle a dispute, or he'll help with muscle from his gang. Any way that he can help, he is helping, and he's offering these weekly Durbar meetings as a way to find out ways that he can help people in the area. So now Lala's status in the area is soaring way up there. He is rich beyond your wildest dreams, and he's meeting with political leaders such as the Prime Minister of India, and he is also throwing huge, lavish parties for the stars of Bollywood. He would always have parties on the day of the Islamic festival of Eid al-Fitr. This man literally ran Bollywood. He set up what they call kangaroo courts, which would sort out any financial discrepancies that any studios had with actors and actresses. It would work out any personal issues that any Bollywood stars had. And honestly, it just seems like Bollywood is just one big unorganized mess until Lala stepped in. When he stepped in, he took a huge chunk of it. He took over the politics of the entire town and pretty much made it his own. After that, Bollywood started to flourish. Everybody has heard of Bollywood. The cinema of China also produces a massive amount of money, movies, etc., etc. But it literally goes America's Hollywood, cinema of China, and then Bollywood. There is pictures to back this up, too, so it's not just, like, gossip that Lala is involved in Bollywood and canoodling with all the Bollywood stars. There is a shit ton of pictures out there with Lala posing with veteran Bollywood actors. So pretty much anybody that has any clout whatsoever in Bollywood is BFFs with Lala, and there is photographic evidence to back this up. Lala would tell journalists that even though he ran Bollywood and had a really close relationship with so many Bollywood celebrities, he never actually watched the films that his town produces because sitting in one place for 3 hours was next to impossible for him. I think Lala's got a touch of that ADD, and whatever, that's totally fine, but it's wild that he's out there representing these people, has such a big interest in Bollywood, and he's managing their careers, he's creating entire movie-producing towns, and he has no idea what kind of work these people do, because he doesn't watch it at all. He doesn't even know if these people are good or bad actors unless somebody tells him. One story that was spoken about pretty openly was a feud between a superstar Bollywood actress, Helen. Her husband, P.N. Arora, treated her like absolute dog trash and threw her out of her house and also threw everything that she owns out onto the front lawn. Helen went to Dilip Kumar for help, and he was a really good friend of hers, and she also knew that he had connections. So Kumar tries to reach out to Lala because Lala is the one that handles disputes in this area. All feuds and everything always goes through Lala, and Kumar is just like way out of his league here. He has no idea what to do. So he's like, oh my god, I gotta get Lala on the phone. Dilip was a Pathan just like Lala, and they were really, really close friends. So he knew that's exactly where he needed to turn. He couldn't get in touch with Lala, so he handwrites a note and sends Helen to Urdu, where Lala is currently staying. She knocks on Lala's door and tells him everything that's going on, shows him the handwritten note that she has. She is crying, she's freaking out, losing her mind, and she doesn't know what to do, and she honestly thinks that even Lala won't be able to handle this issue. Lala was a Pathan, so he does not look at women. That's against his religion. I don't know if it's because of the Pathan or what, but it's in his religion that he is not allowed to look at women. So he goes to her and he's not looking at her, but he addresses her and he's like, all right, listen, like, I know you're upset, but chill. I got this. You came to the right place. I can totally handle this. Go home. It'll all be fine. Helen is, like, super wary because she doesn't really know much about this dude. She's just heard his name. And she's pretty much like, hopefully I'm not going back to my house to get my head blown off by this dude. Like, hopefully Lala can do something because this is legit my last hope. Like, this man is crazy and he's gonna kill me. By the time Helen gets home, her keys had been left at the gate with the guard. Her husband is gone and all of her things that had been sitting on the front lawn were neatly placed back where they were supposed to be. He also had left her a large briefcase of money that he had, like, duped her out of money, out of, like, 50 grand, and there was a large suitcase of that money giving back to her. This event is actually really important. It sounds like a stupid little story, but it's actually a really important event because it was a light bulb moment for a lot of producers in Bollywood. At this time, TV and movie sets are an absolute disaster. They're filled with stars that are completely full of themselves. They are indignant. They are selfish. They would, like, leave sets waiting for hours and hours, waiting for this star to show up, and they would show up, like, 5 hours late, and they'd be like, huh, do something about it. They would have, like, full-blown tantrums and meltdowns on set, and that would cost producers an exorbitant amount of money. Like, it could literally cost them, like, 80 grand to have a temper tantrum and stop shooting that day just because they could. The producer's inability to do anything about it led to the stars pretty much doing whatever they want, and the producers bleeding money through the nose. Cue the Helen story, and producers start lining up down the block to see Lala. See, in one point of view, this is a sweet story about a man who protected a woman that he didn't even know, saved her from domestic violence, got her her money back, and made sure that her and her belongings didn't spend the night on the street. However, on the other hand, this story goes to show the amount of respect and fear that Lala's name carried. How he was able to control even the most obnoxious member of high society, and how he instilled fear immediately and fixed the situation without even having to physically go to this place. Soon enough, Lala starts getting involved in Bollywood, and before you know it, the underworld is bleeding into Bollywood, and they slowly mingle until Bollywood and the underworld become one and the same. Men were brought in from the Pathans to keep the stars in order. There was no more showing up late. These crazy, huge, and scary dudes would be knocking on the star's door like 2 hours before shooting time. There was no more tantrums on set. These guys stepped in and would, like, drag them out and threaten them to calm the fuck down and get back to your job or else. Things started to run exponentially better in Bollywood, and the profits showed that. Before long, with sets running efficiently and stars a bit more scared to step out of line, Bollywood started to flourish further than it ever had before, and it was already a pretty big thing. Stars even started to be treated a little too harshly, like it went from one extreme to the other extreme. A-list celebrities were being physically manhandled back and forth to set. Stars would be forced to complete movies even if they wanted nothing to do with it, and that's regardless of what's going on in their lives. Like, oh, your mom died? Sorry, you're filming today. They would be forced to fly to Dubai and perform at events of top-ranking producers and agencies. The Bollywood world quickly went from one extreme to the other. It went from, like, stars being assholes and doing whatever they wanted to stars being very mistreated. They weren't even allowed to say no to a project. If they were ordered to do it, they were doing it. Can you imagine, like, Leonardo DiCaprio being told that he had to do a movie? He's like, nah, the script isn't good. I don't like it. I don't want anything to do with it. And they're like, huh, psych. No, but we'll be at your house tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. to get you to start filming. See you then. And he's like, wait, what? Like, I don't want to do the... Too bad. A-list celebrity Rajiv Rai, son of Gulshan Rai of Trimurti Films fame, fled to the UK with his family. He didn't even feel safe leaving his family. after a failed attempt on his life due to contract negotiations going south with his production company. Gulshan Kumar of T-Series fame was chased and gunned down for the same thing, contract negotiations going south. Bigwig producers and directors were regularly receiving threatening calls and, like, death threats. And this isn't all due to Lala. Another gangster had made his way into the film industry at the same time that Lala is beginning to take it over. Abu Salem made his way into the industry, and he kind of seems to be the one that's responsible for most of the brutality. The threatening phone calls always came from Salem or his henchmen. Rakesh Roshan, a Bollywood star, was brutally attacked. Although he survived the gunshot wounds that he had, imagine his state of mind after that. Like, you would never be into acting again. At that point, like, you're legit a court jester, forced to perform, like, a singing monkey. Like, you don't really want anything to do with acting at that point. Abu Salem started dating Bollywood elite Monica Betty. He decided that she was going to be the next big thing in Bollywood. So he would threaten and force producers to put her in their movies. She would be seen with top A-list celebrities in movies that she probably didn't even fit the part for. But if they wanted to keep their lives, the producers made it work. Abu Salem and Monica Betty were arrested during a trip to Portugal, and each served prison sentences there in Portugal. After their sentences were completed, they were deported back to India, but it was pretty lengthy prison sentences. Movie stars from all over the world would come to India in order to meet Lala. Events in the late 90s and early 2000s had men like Abu Salem and Kareem Lala taking pictures with, like, the world's biggest celebrities. Singers, actors, performers, musicians, everybody on the planet quickly learned that in India, Bollywood was intermingled with the criminal underworld, and they weren't afraid to let the rest of the world know it. Eventually, after multiple murder attempts on a lot of really big name celebrities, the Mumbai police were forced to intervene in this problem. Big name underworld gangsters were arrested. Abu Salem was in jail in Portugal already, so they couldn't arrest him. But, like, other gangsters that had gotten into it all got arrested. And another big gangster that was in the Bollywood scene was Chota Rajan, and he was put into a Tihar jail. And once Salem was gone, once Rajan was gone, they were able to get the Bollywood industry back under control and into the right hands, and not in the clutches of the underworld's most brutal gangsters anymore. The extortion and mistreatment of celebrities stopped, and the underworld gangsters moved into pirating Bollywood products, but they really didn't have much to do with the celebrities themselves anymore. Which, thank God. While Lala ruled the underworld, as time went on, he began to start feeling his health declining. He started to train his nephew, Samad Khan, to step into his shoes and take his place leading the Pathan gang and just managing all of his criminal enterprises. Samad started to learn to take control of both his legitimate and his illegitimate businesses. He started to manage the hotels, he started to manage the transportation businesses, and he also started to learn about the smuggling, the drug running, the extortion, all of that. Samad also got into a dispute where he gained a few rivals. He was at odds with Sabir Ibrahim Kaskar and Dawood Ibrahim Kaskar. These are two brothers. Dawood, at the time, still has a little bit of lingering beef with Lala as well. He really pissed off Lala by just, like, coming into the scene and partaking in all kinds of illegal activities. It seemed like Dawood and his gang, known as the D Company, were permeating every level of crime. He started getting into the smuggling business. He is seen around Bollywood. He's running protection rackets. He's just stepping all over the Pathan's toes and not giving an absolute shit. Actually, the beef with Dawood got pretty frickin' serious. Tensions between the two groups got so heavy in the 1980s that it led to the Pathan gang murdering Shabir Ibrahim, Dawood's brother, in broad daylight. This ignited a blood war between the two warring gangs, as Dawood had straight up built like a freaking army for himself at this point. So now it's the Pathans versus the D Company. Dawood swore to avenge his brother's death, and 5 years later, he got that chance and he took it. In 1986, Dawood's gang members killed Rahim Khan, Lala's brother, and Samad's father. Eventually, Dawood and his gang were able to completely eliminate Lala and the Pathan gang from all of Mumbai. They did eventually regain their grounds in Mumbai, so it was just a time being sort of thing. But keep in mind, this is way, way late in Lala's life. At this time, Lala is 76 years old. I can pretty much guarantee that Dawood would not have won this war if it was waged 10 years earlier and Lala wasn't, like, almost 80 years old. Like, what are you gonna do when you're almost 80? On February 20th, 2002, Karim Lala died at 90 years old of a massive heart attack at home. It's always wild to me to see these gangsters live these crazy-ass lives and get taken out by something like a heart attack or cancer. But at the end of the day, he made it to 90 years old, so, like, you know, more power to him. I mean, impressive. In 2020, Shiv Sena MP Sanjay Raut came out and confirmed that Karim Lala had met with former Prime Minister Indira Gandhi on several occasions in the 60s and 70s. This made all of Congress go absolutely freaking berserk. Gandhi was a very well-respected former Prime Minister. Her son was currently in the role, and I think that people felt like Raut coming out and saying this is pretty much saying that she was playing around in the underworld during her time as prime minister. Indira Gandhi was the daughter of Jawaharlal Nehru, the first prime minister of India. She was elected as the third prime minister of India in 1966, and she served until March of 1977. She was re-elected in January of 1980, and she left office in October of 1984 when she was assassinated. She was the first and only female to ever serve as Prime Minister of India, and she was the second longest serving Indian Prime Minister, second only to her father. When there was congressional backlash after Raut's comments, he came back to say that Lala was the leader of the Pathan community, and he only saw Prime Minister Gandhi in that capacity, and in the capacity of being a leader of an organization called Pakhtun e Hind. And that Gandhi wasn't the only political leader that he met, that there was plenty of them. He tweeted that people that don't know the history of Mumbai were twisting his statements to seem like it was something bad, but it wasn't anything bad. Raut put out a statement on Twitter that said, "I have never shied away from praising Indira Gandhi as an iron lady who took decisions with iron fists." Surprisingly, those who do not know the history of Indirahi are shouting at the top of their voice. But even when he said that on Twitter, he did say that the mafia don Karim Lala had significant influence on the politics of Maharashtra due to his relationship with Gandhi. He said that Gandhi would meet with Lala pretty often, and they would always listen to him and pretty much give him whatever he wanted because they wanted to avoid making him angry. These comments are what set Congress off. Not like, oh yeah, he met with them. Like, no, these comments of like, he pretty much ran the country. That's what made Congress pissed. P.S. No, her father is not the Gandhi that we all think about when we hear the name Gandhi. To be honest, I really know nothing about that Gandhi. The one that we know of is Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, And he also comes from India. He was a political leader in India, and he practiced satyagraha, resistance to tyranny, through mass nonviolent civil disobedience. So Gandhi seems to be like India's Martin Luther King. Mohandas Gandhi has no relation at all whatsoever with Indira Gandhi. Gandhi is just like a really popular name in India. Lala's grandson, remember the one that I said he raised as his son? Well, I couldn't find anything about his name or his identity, but I stumbled on an article and I found stuff about it and I am so proud of it. You guys don't understand, like every single part of researching this guy is like pulling teeth. Because information on this guy is so rare in English. On YouTube, as I said in the beginning, the only things that you can find are just like people reading off the exact words of the Wikipedia page. So I found new information and I'm super proud of it. So like deal with my enthusiasm. I don't care. His grandson's name was Parvez Khan. He went by the alias Chinku Pathan. Pathan, as I'm going to refer to him now because everywhere that refers to him by that name, so that's what I'm going to call him. So his grandson is Pathan. Pathan followed in his uncle's and his grandfather's footsteps and is the leader of the Pathan gang. He was arrested on January 20th, 2021 by the Narcotics Control Bureau. Want to hear the craziest part of what I found on this report? Do you want to hear it? Because I think this is like the funniest thing that I stumbled upon in this entire case that I've been researching. Pathan was arrested while operating out of a lab of Arif Bujwala, Dawood Ibrahim's gang associate, and his freaking partner. So they're freaking working together now. This gang must be all freaking powerful because there were serious forces fighting against each other. But you put them together, that's a monopoly on crime in Mumbai right there, baby. Like, again, I state for those who did not hear me the first time, this happened in 2021. The Pathans are currently running Mumbai's underworld. There was a serious manhunt for Arif after Pathan was arrested. The NBC launched an immediate manhunt when they arrested Pathan. They put out notices to all airports and ports in order to prevent him from leaving the country. And they did absolutely everything they could, but they could not get their hands on this boy. When Pathan was arrested, police found a one-of-its-kind laboratory where Arif had been manufacturing synthetic drugs. They were producing mephedrone, methamphetamine, which is just regular old meth, and ephedrine there. And all of the paraphernalia that goes along with drug producing is also found in this lab. Packing materials, utensils, weighing machines, all kinds of drug equipment are found in this drug laboratory, it makes sense. Police raided all of the places in Mumbai, as well as the neighborhoods surrounding the area, that they knew that the Pathan gang and the Dawood gang were known to reside. They seized 12 kilograms of drugs, 2 pistols, and a diary. Out of all of the things that they seized, the diary kind of turned out to be the most useful thing for them. The diary contained pretty much everything about the gang. Contact info for major drug suppliers that they worked with, financial details of money that had been made through their various criminal enterprises. Like, everything is included in this diary. The diary was written in code, but it was, like, super simple for the cops to break this code. Like, within 2 minutes of having it, they broke this code and had all the information in there. The cartel that the Pathan and Dawood gangs run is currently responsible for about 70% of the drugs that are sold in Mumbai and Maharashtra. The police were eventually able to arrest Arif, but it lists his name as Mohammed Arif Hingora. So, I mean, it has to be the same person, but his name is listed as Mohammed Arif Hingora, and he was arrested in September of 2021. It seems like it's the same person because the article also says that he had been on the run since Pathan's arrest, which lines up with Arif. He was caught after the dumbass started to set up his drug supply operation in one of the locations that the Pathans were known to have and had already been raided. Legit, only months had gone by since Pathan was arrested. And this moron is like, oh yeah, it's been plenty of time. I can just go back to producing and selling drugs. No biggie. Fuck it, let's do it. Arif sounds like a great person. If you can't pick up on the sarcasm, that's very hard line sarcasm. After Pathan was arrested, he hooked up with African gangs in the area and started using 8 to 10 year old children to run his drugs for him. That obviously made police less suspicious. Who's gonna suspect that a child is carrying drugs? But even if the child was apprehended, it gave Arif time to flee the scene and not get arrested. It's funny because in all of these articles that report on this, Pathan is referred to as Underworld Don Dawood Ibrahim Aide Chinku Pathan. And only a very few number of the articles even report that he is absolute mafia royalty. He's the son of the last leader and that he is related to not only Karim Lala, that's his grandfather that raised him as a son, but he is also relatives with his nephew that took over the operation when he died. Karim Lala had made a serious effort in 1980 to make peace between Samad Khan and the dudes that he was beefing with, Sabahir Ibrahim Kaskar and Dawood Ibrahim Kaskar. The peace negotiations absolutely failed in the 80s, like failed hardcore, could not happen. Peace was eventually obtained with the help of a woman named Jenabai. This woman would eventually go on to become the first mafia queen of the Mumbai underworld. She brought the enemy gangs together, and she joined the hands of Karim Lala and the Ibrahim brothers, and declared that the force that they formed would be so powerful that even the government will stand no chance against it. Jenabai was Haji Mastan's sister, and she prospered on her own after selling and smuggling everything from rice to liquor. Mafia leaders would often go to her for advice, and they would call her Masi or Appa. Lala inspired many Bollywood roles and films. Some of those are Shere Khan from Zanjeer and the latest release of Alia Bhatt named Gangubai Kathiawadi also has AJ Devgan in the role of Karim Lala. So that is all I have for this insane man, Karim Lala. Please don't forget to like, share, comment, follow, do all the things, and I will see you next week. Bye!